You're probably tired of hearing that you need a large platform in order to be successful as an author. For many authors, agents, and publishers, having a large platform is the equivalent of having a large following on social media. Now, if you've been listening to the Christian Publishing Show for any length of time, or if you've listened to my other podcast, Novel Marketing, you know that social media doesn't necessarily actually mean that you have a platform, or at least it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to sell any more books than someone who is not on social media. In fact, sometimes people sell more books by spending less time on social media. And there's an argument to be made about whether or not social media actually connects you with your readers. Now, I've been talking about this for years, and I've been talking about the bot problem on social media, that you could be talking to a bot. And for years, no one believed me. And then ChatGPT was made available to the public. And now, suddenly, everyone totally believes that they could be interacting with bots rather than with real readers. But how do we navigate this? Because a lot of people will hear me say, oh, your social media following isn't very important. But then they'll talk to a literary agent or a publisher, and all those people care about is your social media numbers. Well, we have a literary agent online today, and we're about to have a very interesting conversation. So if you're curious about whether or not you need to be on social media, keep listening to this episode of the Christian Publishing Show. This is the podcast for writers who want to advance Christ's kingdom using excellent writing. And our special guest on the show today is not only a literary agent, but an international best speaker and the author of nearly 50 books. And her popular podcast, Pray Every Day, has been downloaded over 4.5 million times. Mary DeMuth, welcome to the Christian Publishing Show.
Hey, Thomas, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So you wrote a viral blog post titled Why Author Platform is Broken and What to Do About It. So why is Author Platform broken?
Well, in the post, I kind of trace the publishing, Christian publishing industry from like the early 2000s until now, so the past two decades. And I did that because that's how long I've been in it. And so I can intelligently speak to that. And when I started off publishing in 04, 05, I did not need a platform. I needed to write a great book, and I needed to be an excellent writer. And I had spent a long time working on that side of myself. And actually, my first two contracts that came right after I got them, I moved to France. So although there was trepidation in me for sure of, oh no, my dream just came true. Now I'm relocating across the world. It didn't seem to be a problem. So during that time in the when it got to be like 05, 06, 07, they started talking about branding. And that was kind of an important conversation. Like, who are you? What do you bring to the reader? And then that morphed into platform, which started with Michael Hyatt's. It didn't really start with that book, but that was kind of like the zeitgeist of that era. So he wrote a book called Platform, and he had been the president of Thomas Nelson and was now on his own. And he wrote this book, and I read it, and it gave you all sorts of advice about how to grow your following.
I remember doing a webinar with you and Michael when his book launched, because we were teaching courses to authors. And so we were like, hey, here's Michael Hyatt. He's going to teach you all on platform. Like, we were in the hustle and the bustle back in 2012.
We were. And that was the thing. But that has now morphed into a different kind of metric, where it used to be the metric was, how do you connect with readers? And how can you share with a publisher that you sell books, like an actual sales formula? Two, how many people follow you on a social media platform, and what is that combined number? And as an author, because I was an author before I was an agent, I jumped through those hoops. And I've been an agent now for over 3 years, and I've been watching how this has affected not only myself as an author, but my authors as well. And I've also watched how those numbers don't necessarily result in sales. And I've talked to a lot of industry professionals who will back me up on this, but often are not public about it. And so me, being the pot stirrer that I am, decided to write this post to talk about it, because I think there's a lot of exhausted authors out there, and we're giving them some information that is taking away from them rather than adding to them. And I don't necessarily have the perfect solution, but I felt like the questions needed to be asked.
And one of the things that you pointed out in that article, which we'll link to in the show notes if you want to check it out, it has over 100 comments. It really struck a nerve. But one of the things you pointed out in that article is that the platform pressure is higher in Christian publishing than it is mm-hmm. in secular publishing, particularly for fiction. And I have a conspiracy theory as to why this is. So I'm going to share my conspiracy theory and then you can debunk it.
I think it's particularly for nonfiction. I think that's what you meant to say.
Well, the pressures are high for both fiction and nonfiction. But in secular world, there's very little pressure to have a platform if you're writing fiction. They mostly just care if the book is well written. But they do care about platform in religious world. It's not as important as platform is in nonfiction, but there's a lot of novelists who get that as a rejection. So I have two different conspiracy theories. The first one is, I think some agents and editors will blame platform when they really don't like the book, but they don't want to give the reason why they don't like the book, right? They either disagree with it theologically or politically, or they don't think the writing is very good. But all of those things are judgment calls, and they don't want to feel like they're judging. And so blaming platform is the nice way of saying no without really saying no. So it's kind of a passive-aggressive agreeableness issue. So I think that's part of it. But I think that's not the whole picture. So here's my conspiracy theory, and hopefully it doesn't trigger you too badly. So when I first started in this industry, going to conferences in 06 and 07, most of the editors and acquisitions agents had theology backgrounds, or I would say the majority of them had theology backgrounds. These are people who'd gone to seminary. And over my early years in this career, I saw the seminary folks retiring, and they were being replaced by business folks. People with a business background, people like me, like I am a representative of the problem. but then something even deeper happened, and that is a lot of these publishing houses that had been owned by Christians for decades or even centuries started getting sold to secular conglomerates that were not owned by Christians. So we're talking about like Zondervan and Thomas Nelson being sold to HarperCollins, for instance. And the team that worked at those companies turned over almost completely. I don't know if there's anyone left at Zondervan or Thomas Nelson from, you know, the 2000s. Maybe there is, maybe you'd know, but I think a lot of the faces are new faces. And the people that are working there, while some of them are Christians, they're a different kind of Christian. They're more theologically and politically progressive. They're more likely to live in a big city. And they're less like the kind of people who buy Christian fiction, which are conservative, more likely to be suburban, more likely to be rural, more likely to have voted for Trump. And the staff at these Christian publishers aren't able to predict what will resonate with those readers because they're not in that group. They don't go to that kind of church. They don't live in that part of the country. And so they're forced to use platform as a proxy for resonance because they can't make the judgment call on the writing itself, because they don't have the perspective, and because they're a New York City person and they don't know what a rural Alabama Christian romance reader actually wants in a story. So they have to guess based off of who's got a lot of Facebook followers. So that's my conspiracy theory.
Okay, I'm going to push back a little bit. And the only reason I think you're probably right in terms of the fiction side of things, but my experience with nonfiction in New York versus Christian, there's more pressure on the Christian space to have platform. And I think the reason for that is there are thresholds that those publishers have to make in terms of sales, and they are using that as their metric to, they're running scared. In other words, they're risk averse. Whereas in the olden days, people like Eugene Peterson could get published because, like you said, I would agree with you, the editors were more theologically adept, and they're like, oh my gosh, this is so beautiful. This is such a lovely piece of writing, and I'm going to take a risk on it. It may not make money, but they weren't thinking, that wasn't their first thought. Their first thought was, I want to build the kingdom. I want to put something out in the world that's going to change it. And now in a lot of those houses, the first thought is, how do we make money? Now, the difference, I think, between a Christian owned by New York house and just a plain New York house that is just like a secular house, I think, is that the plain New York house has more money and has more of an ability and understanding of the importance of marketing and sales for those authors that they take on. Whereas I feel like a lot of the nonfiction authors in the Christian space, almost 100% of the burden is placed on them to sell the book. And when they don't, they get blamed.
Yeah. And I think it's also potentially a element of, because they're based in New York, and because there's this disconnect between the publishers and the readers, they don't know how to do the marketing. Not that they're doing a good job for their own New York books either. I had a very fascinating conversation with Jane Friedman on my other podcast, Novel Marketing, where we went over the Penguin Random House Department of Justice trial. And it turns out that things in New York aren't great. These companies are not growing. And they're, most of the books that they publish really fail. Something like 16 to 17% of big five books fail to sell more than a dozen copies.
Which is
kind of mind-blowing, right? So these are books that are completely falling on their face. And these are houses that are really sustained by the massive backlists that they have, not because they are doing a good job calling balls and strikes and kind of predicting where the market is going and what the typical reader wants. And when I look at New York, they seem to be very politically motivated, right? There's a very specific kind of political message that's really getting favored, a very specific kind of author they're wanting to publish. And they're almost not caring about how well marketable the book is, as long as it checks certain boxes. And that's kind of new, because New York historically has been very financially motivated. And I don't know if we'll, you know, really get to the why behind this, but the what is very real. And the fact that it's not working, I think, is really interesting, because you'd think, oh, if this author's got a million social media followers, obviously they're going to be able to sell a whole lot of books. It was Billie Eilish, right? She has something like 100 million followers on social media, and her book failed despite that. Why? It's like, doesn't a following on social media guarantee success with your book once it comes out?
It does not. And that's what we're learning. I talked to an editor in a Christian house who had that similar thing happen, where they had an author with a high Instagram following, hundreds of thousands of followers. And she said that book just tanked. And I asked why. And she was like, I think it's because there's no commitment in scrolling Instagram. And if I want design ideas or recipe ideas, I will just keep scrolling. I don't need to hold a book in my hand to get those ideas. In fact, I don't really want a book, because it will be out of touch in a few years. And so those kinds of lifestyle bloggers / Instagrammers / influencers, a lot of people are used to receiving really free content. Plus, they are not connected to that person very much, because they're following a whole bunch of people. And they may or may not see their posts on their feed, and they don't have an established relationship versus, and you and I have been preaching this forever, versus an email list where people trust the emailer and then buy from them because they've established a relationship of trust. But in social media, it's so fickle, it changes all the time. It's nearly impossible to have a relationship of trust there.
And there's no mechanism to buy. So not only is there no trust relationship, but even if I do trust you, I'm following you on Instagram and I see your post about your new book, there's no buy button. Right? The friction of me leaving the platform and not getting the dopamine hit of scrolling up to the new thing, and instead saying no to that dopamine to open up a separate app, type in the title of your book, do a search on Amazon, go to the page, click order, and then wait for it to arrive in the mail. That's a lot of friction. And each point of that process is going to have some big percentage of people who won't complete it, right? The more steps you have in a funnel, the smaller percentage of people will complete the scavenger hunt. And the result is that a tiny fraction of people that do trust you go on to buy. But the other change that's happened is, and this is, to be fair to Michael Hyatt, his method worked better back in 2012.
Yeah.
When he wrote his book, because the algorithms in those days sorted based off of recency and they encouraged virality. After the election in 2016, the algorithms were all shifted to really discourage virality because there was a concern that misinformation could spread like a virus. And so now things, it's really hard for something to go viral on social media, good or bad, because of the way the algorithm has been tweaked. But now the algorithm is becoming the thing that people are a fan of. So people often will say, oh, I'm a big fan of TikTok, but they won't say anyone specific on TikTok that they're a fan of because they're just scrolling. It's like flipping through channels on the television. And the TikTok algorithm could make someone disappear and you may not even notice that they're gone from your feed for weeks or months because you're not connected with that creator. You're connected with the algorithm and the algorithm is able to shape your understanding of the world. It's able to shape your desires and your understanding and guide your actions. And you as a human don't have control over that as a creator, and you have almost no control over it as a consumer. And as all of the platforms are becoming TikTok, right? What is Instagram rapidly trying to become? It's trying to become TikTok, right? It's pushing reels really hard. It's trying to recreate that TikTok experience inside of Instagram. YouTube's doing the same. Facebook's doing the same. The more that people are following algorithms rather than humans, the less of an ability you can use to reach humans for free through an algorithm.
Yes, I agree. And so when we're being strategic about it, and I'm not perfect at it by any stretch, I have to ask myself, and the question I've been asking myself as an author has been, how can I use these fleeting platforms to build my email list? Because that is the permanence that I own. And then, of course, how can I direct them to my website? And how can I maximize my SEO, which I'm terrible at, on my website to have people naturally come there as well? And of course, the girls from Writing Off Social are talking about this as well. And so there are some ways that we can kind of pretend the algorithm doesn't matter because it kind of doesn't. And find other ways. And there's a lot of other ways too. Like as an agent, I look at proposals all the time. And I do look at platform because I have to. Because if I send something to an editor, they're looking at it. So I can't just discount no platform. But I am also looking a lot deeper at other things. Like one of my clients, he self-published a book and he sold over 10,000 copies of that self-published book. Well, that was an easy yes for me because that was hard data. And then I signed another client who's not great on social, but she sold tens of thousands of books of her traditionally published books. And so when I pitched her to publishing houses, there was five fighting over her because that's hard data. And so if you can give me some hard data, I don't care as much about how many people follow you. That to me moves the needle more. It's more interesting to me.
One of the reasons why I really like email newsletters as a mechanism. And when we did the Novel Marketing Conference, when I was sorting people based off of platform, because we had a couple of groups that were the people with the very largest platforms and they were together in a group, the only question I asked was how many email subscribers they have, because it's an indication of being faithful in the little things. It's an indication that you've been able to build that trust and that people actually know who you are and they're not just scrolling past your videos. And you're like, oh, you're the funny person with the funny hair or whatever on TikTok, right? There's actually some effort that's been made. And if they're not going to trust you with their email address, why would they trust you with their money? But you're right that there are other ways to do it other than email. And one of those is in the real world. So Trisha Goyer does a great job going to homeschool conventions and selling books directly to homeschoolers. And there's a whole ecosystem of authors who are selling often tens of thousands of copies of their books directly to readers, cash on the barrel, right? So this is not tracked by eBookScan. This is not tracked even by credit cards. And who knows, maybe they're not even paying sales taxes, right? Like, this is almost a black market of books at these conferences. I'm sure most of them are collecting sales taxes.
Yes.
But the point I'm trying to make is it's very easy to discard it because they're like, oh, well, according to NPD BookScan, there's no sales at writers' conferences. And it's like, they're not tracking the sales there. So, of course, they're going to show a zero. But there's actually a lot of sales there. Or somebody who speaks a lot in front of big rooms. You know this. You'll give a talk in front of a room full of people, and then you'll be signing books and selling books for 30 minutes, an hour afterwards, as there's this line of people paying full price or even a markup because they don't want change to buy your book. And those things really matter. And the other thing that you said, I really want to underline this. Once you have numbers of sales, nobody really cares about your platform, both good and bad, right? If your last book sold 50 copies, it doesn't matter that you have a million people following you on TikTok.
Yeah.
Your last book only sold 50 copies. And if your last book sold 50,000 copies, it doesn't matter that you're not on Facebook. People are still going to bid for your book because your last book sold 50,000 copies. So ultimately, these are businesses. They're trying to sell books. You want to show that you've been faithful in the little things. You want to show that you have resonance with readers, that readers already want what you're creating. And there's a lot of ways to do that. And social media isn't the way to do it. Because another problem with social media is that it's not a good way to get famous. The people who are famous on social media and who can use it to move numbers are people who first got famous doing something else. They were an athlete. They were an actor. They were a successful author already. And being a successful author led to a following on social media. And we often confuse that. And we're like, oh, millionaires, they all wear a suit and tie. If I wear a suit and tie, I'll be a millionaire too. It's like, no, that's not a causal connection. The fallacy for this is post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this. And correlation is not causation. It's the modern way to say it. Yeah. And just because somebody has a lot of followers on social media, it doesn't mean that they got those followers by being good at social media. And often I'll see successful authors put burdens on new authors. They're saying, look at me, I'm popular on social media. You need to be popular on social media too, without explaining, oh yeah, I got popular 20 years ago on social media because I had a best-selling book at the time and that brought in all these people into my platform. And that is a completely non-reproducible path for someone who didn't already have that best-selling book in the olden days.
Well, and I have a little story too to tell that's very frustrating. And that is that I had a new author that I signed. She's delightful and she knows someone exceptionally famous in the Christian writing sphere and is good friends with her. And this famous woman said to her when she signed, she's, oh yeah, I signed with Mary. And the woman said, okay, the very first thing you need to do, I mean, this is above all other pieces of advice. She said, the first thing you need to do is start buying followers. And I was so angry at that because first of all, that is fake. Second of all, then you, if you're rich, you can buy followers. Third of all, those aren't really followers. And it's creating kind of a Potemkin village of a facade of unreality that means nothing. And so when I look at people's numbers, I have to look at engagement because if they're being followed by bots that they bought, there's not going to be any engagement there. And it just is a piece of fluff that means they spent their money on something dumb. So please don't buy followers.
Well, but here's the thing. The bots now can do engagement. The bots can like your posts and they can generate a comment based off of what you posted. So even that tool that totally worked 3 years ago, four years ago of like, oh, I don't look at your total number of followers. I look at how engaged your followers are. If you're paying for the good bots, they're very engaged followers. Like the whole world is lies. The social media world is just lies. there's no like compass. There's no North Pole to let you know what's real and what's not real and what's created by a human and what's not created by a human. Because GPT can generate a better comment off of your video or your reel or your photo than most humans can typing with their thumbs on the toilet, right? Mm. Like we're not comparing our best to the computer's best. The GPT always brings its best. And us as humans, we don't. Right? Our commas sometimes don't have good punctuation. Sometimes we misspell words, and GPT knows how to look really human and create as much artificial engagement as you want. And this is not at all new. In the 2008 presidential race, there's a certain candidate who got onto a major party's debate stage purely off of the fact that he had a zillion Twitter followers, only for later everyone realized, oh, those were all bots. But no one knew how to tell back then. It didn't seem like this guy had a lot of heat, and he was hip with the young people, and the youths were all about him. And it was really just a handful of savvy marketers and an army full of bots. And this is in 2008. That's 16 years ago. Nothing has changed. What is real is what we see in real life. Your big advantage as an author is that you're a human being and you can interact with people in the real world. And we got dazzled by social media, and social media scratched that psychological itch of we wanted validation, right? Some people are writing because they want to feel validated and encouraged, and you can get a form of that, right? You can like, hey, this person's my friend. This person likes what I said. And they're not your friend. They're your Facebook friend. You can't sleep on their couch. They didn't like what you said. They clicked like under what you said. That's not the same thing.
Yeah, I recently had breakfast with someone who I met through social media. So this was an example of a reader who messaged me a few times, and turns out she lived nearby. And so we've met several times for breakfast, and it's been a really fun thing to see that relationship develop. So social media can be a handshake or an introduction, but I would never even remember her face or her name had I not met her in person. And I don't know if I have face blindness, but I feel like a lot of us kind of have face blindness these days because of social media. I'll have people come and say, oh, well, I follow you on Twitter. Well, that little tiny picture is so little. If I've never met the person, I will never really know who they are. And so that's why I think we do need to get back to humanity, human beings, touching people one-on-one. And for traditional publishing, there's always an opportunity for another way.
Now, you're in those conversations with these acquisitions editors, and if you had a client who had a robust email list, and they also said, I don't do social media because I think that it's toxic or evil, or I disagree with the politics, right? They have kind of a moral objection to social media, or a mental health one, right? Because there's a whole other angle of this we haven't talked about, which is that science shows that social media is bad for you. It's like smoking. It's like there's no studies that show that it's good for your health, and a lot of studies show that it's bad for your health, and a lot more studies on the way. But putting all of that aside, if you had a client who had, let's say, 10,000, 15,000 emails on an email list, would the publisher even care if they had social media numbers, or is the email list enough to cover the fact that they don't even have an account on Facebook?
They would still care. They would still want to know if they had a presence, and they would still use it as a reason to say no. And I would say there's a threshold there. If they had 50,000 emails and above, then it wouldn't matter as much. 10,000 is a little bit low. And again, that's always a moving target. But another thing that can be hard for me in representing is if someone's kind of got a dabbling in everything and has kind of the high number, but it's on small platforms in different places. It's really hard to, you can give that final number and that's a wow number, but it may not mean anything because they may not be really engaged on any of those platforms. And it's a lot, like Eugene Peterson said, it's a long obedience in the same direction. It is methodical. It is being faithful in little things. And also it is about the kingdom. And so you cannot measure things by the world's metrics. Now, I understand, and I'm constrained by publishing. So I understand that when I present a project to a publisher, that I have to give them what they want, you know, in terms of what they're asking for. But thankfully, we live in an era where we can always publish a book for free for the most part. And so if it doesn't work for this kind of publishing, for traditional publishing, there's always an opportunity for another way.
And you're not going to get any heat from the algorithms, any of the specific algos. They're not going to give you heat if you don't have big numbers to start with. So, you know, it's a bunch of voices all kind of lost in the noise rather than one loud, clear voice. And finding that one platform that you can really focus on, I think is better.
Yeah,
of the platforms that I like, I like podcasting because there's no algorithm in between you and your reader.
Yep.
And I like blogging because there's very little algorithm in between. And blogging and email are very simpatico, right? Mm-hmm. Like Substack basically merges blogs and emails.
Yep.
It's just the same thing. And is it an email or is it a blog? It's like, well, how do you want to read it? You want to read it on the website or do you want to read it in your inbox? It's the same content. And you can do the same thing with your own website. You don't have to use Substack. But those are the big three. And what's interesting is that of the online things, those all have something in common in that they are not companies. They're technologies. Blogging is a technology. Podcasting is a technology. Email is a technology. And you can get that technology from rival companies, right? You don't have to have an @outlook.com email address, right? There are other companies that will be happy to give you email, right? You don't have to use MailChimp. In fact, please don't use MailChimp. It's the worst. MailerLite and ConvertKit are much better. And the fact that there's competition means that you're treated as a customer. If you don't like your podcast host, you can move to another podcast host and keep your subscribers. Same with your website host. Same with your email service provider. With these platforms, you're treated like a customer. But if you decide you don't like Facebook and you want to move to Twitter, you have to start over from scratch. You don't actually own that relationship with your subscribers there. And so you're also very vulnerable to being canceled. If you say something that offends the wrong people, you can lose everything. If your platform is built on social media, whereas if your platform is built on email or podcasting or blogging, it's more secure. And one area where I think we differ is that people who listen to Novel Marketing, I say, if you're building your platform and you have a large email list and your publisher is pressuring you to do social media, you don't want them as a partner because it indicates that they don't understand marketing. Like they fundamentally don't understand how to look at numbers and how to see what works, because social media has not driven numbers since I was looking at the numbers back in 2016 as the marketing director at Enclave. That was the beginning of my awakening. And that was 8 years ago. That was a long time. And social media has only gotten worse since then. And I saw it in the numbers back then that it wasn't driving sales. And so if you're going to go with the publishing house, you want to go with the publishing house that can lift the water with marketing. Because otherwise, why give up the data? Because if you independently publish, you have access to the marketing data and the margins, and you can do it yourself well. And we're seeing in certain genres, like YA, and in some fantasy genres, and some romance genres, where the indie authors are outselling all of the traditionally published authors. You go to Christian YA, you're going to see S.T. Smith there at the top of the list with more sales than all the traditionally published authors. If you go to Christian Fantasy on Amazon, it's Brian Gadawa. He's like half of the top 10 in any given week. He's independently published. This is what we're seeing is that traditionally published authors who are with houses that don't understand marketing and are pressuring them to do things that don't work are losing market share, particularly in ebooks, to savvy indies who know how to read a sales analytics report and know how to keep doing what's working and stop doing what doesn't work.
Yeah, I would echo that as well. I think there are, you know, I've had lots of conversations and I have thankfully had a few of late, especially after this blog post that I wrote, with upper echelons in Christian publishing who are quietly saying, "You're right. It doesn't mean sales." And they're finally kind of, I think why it's easy is that it's a fixed number that you can look at. Like it's kind of lazy. Like, okay, they have 100,000 followers. That's a number that you can see. It's harder to analyze, okay, well, what's their open rate, or, you know, the other things that may be a little harder to find. And so there is that, well, we don't really know what the metric is, but this one is a number that we can see.
I remember being in high school chemistry and my teacher trying to teach us the difference between accuracy and precision, right? So that number is very precise, right? I can know I have exactly 10,231 followers on Facebook. It's very precise. And because it's very precise, and because I can copy that number and put it into a spreadsheet, it makes me feel like it's accurate and that it conveys reality in a real way. When in reality, many of those people quit Facebook for political reasons or mental health reasons. And other of those people aren't even people. They're bots that are just using me to launder some other thing to look real. And some of those people are humans, but the algorithm's not showing them the content. Right? Like, once you start walking through that number, you're like, gosh, that 10,000 isn't really 10,000. It's not an accurate number, even though it's a very precise number. And I'm encouraged to hear that publishing houses are getting away from that. And in the secular world, there's a publishing house called Bloom that was the best selling romance house. They do a lot of erotica and stuff that as Christians, we wouldn't want to read, but they're winning by giving the authors access to the data and they're able to outmaneuver and they're kind of reinventing what it means to be a traditional publishing house and going after indies who are successful and giving them a reason to go traditional. And the thing is that indies are not wowed by a big advance. What the indies want is more control and more access to sales data. They want to know how many books sold on February 17th
yep.
and how that compared to February 16th and if the big promo on February 17th was successful or not. That's not a big ask, but that's a question as a traditionally published author you typically can't get the answer to.
Never know.
And so that big promo could have been a complete massive hit and you don't know. Or it could be a total failure and you don't know. And so you just keep trying things, not knowing if they work or not. And that is not the recipe for success. If publishers are going to require authors to do the marketing, they have to give the data or they have to do the marketing. Asking somebody to drive down the road and not letting them look out the windshield is a recipe for failure.
Mm-hmm. And crashing.
Yeah. Painful, painful crashing.
Yes.
So what encouragement would you give to an author who they're looking at their email list and they've got 75 people on MailerLite and they heard you say 50,000 and that seems insurmountably far away? What would you say to that person?
I would say, I think one thing we do well at Married Muse Literary is all our authors work together to help build each other's platforms. And we did a cross promotion of building lists and building followers. You know, I think it was like 15 of the 40 authors got together and each of us added 1,000 people to our list. And so that kind of collaboration of connecting with other authors is a really great way to build your list. Obviously, you've talked about this ad infinitum about creating something people want and giving it away. My best list people, honestly, are people that listen to me live as a speaker. And those have been the most faithful followers. There have been people that have been following me that way since 05. And so almost 20 years that have never jumped off. And why is that? Because what I deliver to them is valuable. And I deliver to them content that they cannot get anywhere else. And it is exclusive. And that, I think, is more interesting to me that I have a congregation, so to speak, of readers that I'm shepherding rather than my 20,000 followers on Instagram. I don't know those people, but I know my email list.
Yeah, because that interaction's richer, right?
It is.
The people on Instagram click heart. The people that subscribe to your email newsletter email you back. And you know, not every email, you know, thank God, right? Because that would overwhelm your inbox.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, they email you back. And those are really informative because you're getting somebody's real effort, right? When I get emailed from a subscriber, it's typically a paragraph, sometimes two, three.
Yep.
Sometimes it's their life story.
Yeah.
It's very illuminating. And I read every single one and I try to respond as much as possible. And that's a much richer connection. But it's not nearly as rich as it existing in real life. And I think what you said at the beginning about, you know, a lot of people joined in real life first is really key. The more you can do in person, we are a part of a very physical religion, right? You cannot make an elder of a church without touching them, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot be baptized without touching the water. You cannot do communion by posting a bread emoji and a wine emoji in the chat on Zoom. That's not real communion.
Right?
How do you test the spirits? What did St. John tell us to tell the Antichrist spirit? How do you tell if a spirit is an Antichrist spirit? You ask the spirit about Christ. Do you ask him if Christ is the Son of God? No. Do you ask if Christ was divine? No. You ask if he existed in the flesh. That's the thing. That's the tell between the Antichrist and the true Christ is the physical nature of Jesus, mm-hmm. the humanity of Christ. There's something really powerful about that. And it's very easy for us to get sucked into this virtual world and think that it's a substitute, that the, you know, wine emoji is the same as actually taking, partaking the cup with fellow believers. And it's not. It is not a substitute. And the more that we go back to church and to fellowship with other human beings who follow Christ, and the more we interact with human beings who don't follow Christ, the more vibrant our spiritual walk will be, the more vibrant our writing will be, and the more effective our marketing will be. It doesn't have to be all online. And I'm saying this as a very tech savvy millennial, right? I'm not the like Amish guy, right? I'm the first guy to buy all the technology, but my eyes are being opened to the importance of real life interaction, that that's where the life change happens. And that's where the connections are formed.
I agree. And I think that also gets back to kind of my dissatisfaction with a megachurch model, is you're disconnecting from the oikos of day-to-day communion with other believers and connection. And nobody grows in isolation. Nobody. And I'm an author, so I write books about growing in Christ. So I am for that, definitely. But I actually grow a lot better if I read a book and talk to somebody about it, or I pray through it with someone, or I talk to my husband because I feel like it's heretical or something, you know, like you have to talk about it because it, you need to process it with a live human being. And so I guess for me as an agent, I am looking for people, first of all, who I like. I mean, that's really important. I have to get along with them, but also people who have a mindset of the kingdom, of also who like to push against barriers and like to push against kind of the status quo of what American Christianity has become, which has been very consumeristic and devoid of discipleship. Like, I want to see new voices. I want to see great writing. I want to see people who have an audience and who are connected and know how to serve their audience. And so if you look at my authors on marriedmeethliterary.com, you'll see not a lot of them you know about. Like, they're just kind of flying below the radar, but they are doing beautiful things for the kingdom, and God is blessing that. Maybe not in numbers, but in depth and in width and in changed lives, and also the relationships that we connect together as a literary agency, because we're all connected to each other.
Mary DeMuth Literary is the website. She has submission guidelines there on her website. If you're curious about having her represent you, if you're looking for a literary agent, she'll give you a sense of what she's looking for and what she's not looking for. And the reason why I'm not going over those guidelines now is that for those of you listening in the future, they might have changed. What she's looking for may shift around a little bit. But we'll have a link to Mary DeMuth Literary in the show notes for this episode. And I do encourage you to check out Mary's blog post on this. And I know we have a lot of industry professionals who listen to this podcast, and I want to encourage you to start pushing back. And the best way to push back is to just ask for the numbers. Ask, how do you know that that's true? How do you know that that works? And you'll find that the people pushing for social media cannot answer that number-based question. Mm-hmm. People pushing for social media cannot answer those kinds of questions. And very quickly, their whole argument falls down. It's very interesting because one of my sons, he's a bit of a free spirit. So the children at the playscape at church are all doing one thing and he's doing something else. And they'll come complaining to me because he's not participating in the game that they've all put together. And they're like, he's doing it wrong. And so my answer is, who says he's doing it wrong? They don't have an answer to that. It's like, he's breaking the rules. And I'm like, whose rules? It's like, you're trying to pressure my child into doing what you're doing, and he doesn't want to do it with you. And this is how, if you're facing peer pressure in a corporate setting, in a religious setting, just go back to first principles and be like, says who? What's your proof? What are your evidence? And hopefully they'll be like, oh, well, we found a way to make it work. And here's the numbers, right? Because I've seen the numbers, right? Advertising can work. If you're willing to spend money, you know how to target your audience. It can work. It's harder than it used to be, especially for Christians, but there still are ways. And so if they have the numbers, great. But very often, I think you'll find internally, they don't have the numbers and they just think that everyone else is doing it. And we need more people to say that the emperor has no clothes. And the social media emperor is naked. So it's time to stop complimenting each other about how beautiful his clothes are when he's not wearing any clothes.
Oh, I agree. Thank you for saying that, Thomas. And I think, too, what I want to bring to people listening to the show today is freedom. And again, I mean, I don't want to misrepresent myself. I do have to look at numbers as a literary agent, but I want authors... I would much rather an author spent their deep work, you know, getting back to like Cal Newport, their deep work on their words on the page than their deep work kind of throwing their pearls before swine on social media. Cause you can't duplicate. It's so shallow there. You're throwing your most beautiful work to bots and to people that are going to consume it quickly versus putting your words on the page that is a more thoughtful interaction with your reader.
Our featured patron today is Deborah Rainey, author of Breath of Heaven. Married life in a remote village on the mission field was supposed to be an adventure for Natalie and her husband, David. But when their village in South America is invaded and a young mother goes missing, their faith and love will be pushed to the limits. Join Natalie and David as they fight for their lives and make decisions that will impact generations to come in the gripping final installment of the Camfield Legacy series. Deborah Rainey, thank you so much for being a patron of the Christian Publishing Show. It is your support and the other patrons like you that keep this podcast on the air. The Christian Publishing Show is a production of AuthorMedia.com. Our guest is Mary DeMuth. The audio editing is by William Umstadt. The blog post is by Shauna Lettler. The producer is Lori Christine. And I am Thomas Umstadt Jr., your host. You can find the blog version of this episode along with links to everything we talked about today at ChristianPublishingShow.com/150. Thank you for listening and live long and prosper.